listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ben Bradley is one of the most respected figures in the history of American journalism. He was the executive editor of The Washington Post when it published the Pentagon Papers and later oversaw the reporting of the Watergate scandal that led to President Richard Nixon's resignation. Jason Robards portrayed him in the film All the President's Men. Jeff Himmelman, a former reporter at the Post and Bob Woodward's one-time research assistant, has written a new authorized biography called Yours in Truth, The Personal Portrait of Ben Bradley. Mr. Himmelman was given access to never-before-seen internal memos, personal letters, and interview transcriptions that reveal, among other things, new information about Watergate, Bradley's personal friendship with President John F. Kennedy, and his relationship with Washington Post owner Katharine Graham. It's published by Random House, and I'm very pleased to welcome Jim Himmelman to our show today. Hello. Well, Jeff Himmelman, I'm sorry.
Hello, thanks. It's nice to be here.
All of those names that begin with J. Later I'll call you Joshua.
Someone called me Richard this morning, so that's an improvement.
Over the years, myths have been developed over it,
sure,
how Watergate was covered by the Washington Post, and your book certainly adds to some of the mystery. Mm-hmm. You cite an interview quote from 1990 where Ben Bradley said there was a residual fear in his soul that some of the Watergate details, particularly Bob Woodward's dealings with Deep Throat, may have been embellished. Did he get any more specific than that?
No, and in particular, he didn't say embellished. And in fact, in a later interview, he said, if you would ask me directly if I would say he embellished, I would say no. But he was speaking to kind of a general phenomenon which occurred with that story, which was unlike any other story really in the history of at least modern print media, which is that it made a jump from the newspaper to the book to the movie. And the way it was ingrained in our sort of cultural memory became a little bit unmoored from what actually happened at the paper. And I think what he was saying is, don't hold me to the Hollywood version of these events. And that reaction has made some people uncomfortable, but I think it's a pretty reasonable reaction.
Well, everybody knows that Follow the Money is something, I think, that William Goldman
exactly
wrote, and
exactly
not something that Deep Throat really said.
Exactly.
But still, you get the feeling he had certain misgivings about what was going on. Was it simply because this was such a big story?
I think so. And I think when you're dealing with something that becomes, in essence, I mean, everything that went into the Post has been borne out to be true. That reporting is brass solid. The story of Watergate is brass solid. Nobody is making any allegation that it isn't. But I think,
and we even know who Deep Throat is.
Exactly, now. Exactly. And so I think, but it has attained this kind of aura in our culture. And I think, 18 years, you know, after most of the reporting that went into those stories was happening in 1972. So 1990, Ben is sitting back and he's thinking, you know, gosh, this is such a huge thing. All he was responsible for was what went into the paper. And I think Ben has zero reservations about what went into the paper.
Still, you talked to him about it. You talked mm-hmm. to Woodward about it. And then you had the two of them together to talk
I
about
did.
It. So that must have been an uncomfortable moment.
It was. It was.
You were just doing fact-checking?
Well, I mean, it was I wouldn't call it fact-checking. I mean, I brought the documents over to Bob, and we had a long on-the-record interview. My tape recorder was running. And then the following week, it became clear that he was really unhappy with that sentiment of Ben's, that it troubled him. And he was very clear that he didn't think I should include it in my book. And I decided, I mean, I had a choice to make. And I decided that it was something that I was reporting in the due course of my book and that I had an obligation to include it. It was what happened.
He had been your mentor.
Yes.
You had worked
yes,
for
I worked
him,
for him for 3 years.
But he must have also understood that it is a reporter's responsibility to tell the whole story.
I hope he understands that. I don't think his current reaction has really borne that out, but I think that
so he's not talking to you at parties?
Not at the present moment, I don't think so. But I think in time people will understand that, and the reaction to the book will reflect that.
Now, Ben Bradley was here 1995, was it?
That was when his book came out. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, well, he came on the book tour. It was a memoir. Now, memoirs aren't always 100% factual. Was this meant to augment what he wrote in that?
Well, as I think you can probably imagine, writing a book about someone who's already written a memoir is a challenge in and of itself. But where I was aided in that was...
Well, this is authorized.
Yes,
so
yes.
he wanted the full
he
record.
He gave me access. And one of the amazing things about Ben Bradley is that he gave me access, and he never, ever said, tell me what you're going to print, show me in advance. He always said, I'll read it in hardcover. But where I was really aided was by those archives themselves, because Ben was not going to write in his own book, look at this hilarious letter I wrote to so-and-so, you know, George McGovern in 1976. But so for a young person, I wasn't born when Watergate happened, so this is all history to me. For a young person to go through these files and look at this icon of journalism whose career spanned, I mean, JFK, the Pentagon Papers, Watergate, Janet Cook, all the way to 1991, to be able to look at the sort of grains of that career was a fascinating journey, and I feel that I was able to bring a lot of things that he couldn't write about himself to light.
Is it ironic that Bob Woodward actually kind of got you the job?
It's either ironic or coincidental, depending on your vantage point.
Now, you said that there was a lot of material. Where was he storing this stuff? Did he save everything? Every memo?
Well, I don't know that he saved everything. I certainly couldn't allege that he did. So the Post has a storage facility out in Springfield, Virginia, and so boxes would come in from there. And we requisitioned what we thought was every box every time, but boxes just kept showing up. So in a very sad footnote, 8 boxes showed up after I'd already written my book, which you can imagine the fear with which I opened those boxes, wondering if there were going to be, you know, new revelations. But one of the things about Ben that you learn very quickly is that Ben's a pretty consistent guy. And so there was nothing in the – there was some little stuff I wish I could have included, but nothing too earth-shaking.
My guest is Jeff Himmelman. His book, Yours in Truth, A Personal Portrait of Ben Bradley, a personal portrait. So
yeah.
You're suggesting this is your take on Ben Bradley?
Yeah, and that was an important piece, I think, sort of truth in advertising as to what the book actually is. Because there are moments where I'm really present in the book. And I think, you know, I'm not claiming that this is the most objective book in the world about Ben Bradley himself, because I clearly feel a lot of affection for him. And I let that speak in the book, and I think that's an important component of the book.
This must have caused a big stir at the Washington Post. The reviewer of your book, the Washington Post, said Bob Woodward is the star of the new Ben Bradley book. What was your response when you read that?
I was disappointed. I'm not going to sugarcoat that one too much. I was disappointed. I guess I didn't feel... I don't feel that Bob Woodward is the star of my book. I don't think anybody who reads my book and really thinks about it would come to that conclusion. But I understand that at the Post there was some consternation about it, and they're free to run their own criticism, and they did.
How well did you know Bradley when you started doing this? Had you met with him?
Only very dimly. So very quickly, the way it worked was Bob recommended me to go write a book with Ben, basically for Ben. He had another book left on his deal. That was when I got first access to the archives and became so entranced by them. And then Ben decided he didn't want to do another book, and so I co-wrote a book with their son, Quinn, a memoir called A Different Life, which came out in 2009, which is it's a book I'm very proud of. I think it's a really lovely book, and Quinn is a really lovely guy. And when that was finished, they kind of said, what are you going to do next? And I said, these archives are so incredible. If you would let me dig in there and write, I would love it. And they gave me full access.
And when you started reading through the documents, did you get a sense of the character of Ben Bradley?
Absolutely.
It different from the person you had met?
No. I mean, so over the course of working on the book with their son and stuff, I'd gotten to know Ben better. And so then when I really dug into the archives, that was when sort of his real history came to life for me. And so the letters, they're scattered throughout the book. I mean, they're just... some of them are just astonishing.
But and you write that at one point you wondered whether he really understood how deeply you were digging around in his past. Did was he even aware of all the things that were in those boxes?
Yeah, and I would bring stuff to him. And so, you know, he's not going to recall at 89 years old exactly what was said during a meeting. But I could bring him a memo that he wrote to Howard Simons, his former managing editor, in which he really rips into Simons. And they had some sort of unresolved issues between them, shall we say, and a very tough memo. And so I brought it into him, and I said, it said not sent on the top. And so I brought it into him, and I said, you know, what do you make of this? And he scanned it, and he said, makes a pretty good case, doesn't it? He just slid it back to me.
So he doesn't
not
have
stepping
any,
back from it at all.
And he doesn't have any memory problems these days?
I mean, he's a 90-year-old man at this point. And so his recall of facts from 1972. I mean, the Watergate reporting, I was not relying on him to recount those tales to me. That's where the physical documents were so important. And so most of what Ben did for me was react.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you were reading an editor's reactions also to things that were coming his way. Follow up on this, or can this be true? Those kinds of things.
Absolutely. And some of that, sadly, was in that last batch of boxes that came after I wrote the book. But a lot of those were, you know, chase this down, follow that. But there were some lovely letters that I couldn't include. which I wish I could have, including some signed Years in Truth, although also some of those make it into the book as well.
Now, Washington is also a very social place, and he comes from a family of privilege.
Mm-hmm.
Did that help him?
I mean, it had to have. I think, and as I write in the book, I think for Ben, he kind of had it both ways with his upbringing. I mean, he was a WASP, and he loved to poke fun of WASPs, loved to stick it to WASPs.
He went to Harvard.
He went to St. Mark's Prep School in Harvard. He graduated early from Harvard to go to World War II, where he served on destroyers in the Pacific. And then when he came back while he was in the war, he decided he wanted to be a journalist. He wanted to make a difference, and he thought that was the way he could do it. I think that was probably a pretty good prediction.
And he wound up at the Post in 1948.
He did. He did, in a very sort of coincidental moment, you might say, which is he had two interviews. He had one set up at the Baltimore Sun and one at the Post. And when he got to Baltimore, when the train pulled into Baltimore, it was raining so hard that he just stayed on the train.
But the Post was a very different newspaper in those days.
Very different newspaper. At that time, it was sort of running third in a four-newspaper town. It was run at that time by Phil Graham, who was Kay's husband. Very tight budget. I mean, as Ben would say, you had to wait for some poor guy to die in order to get a promotion to the national desk. So they were very tight with the purse strings. It was a very different operation.
And he was also at Newsweek.
But that
was before the Newsweek was owned by the Post.
Yes, he helped to broker that deal. That deal was in large part Ben Bradley's idea. And in 1961, when that happened, that was largely Ben's doing. Ben went to Phil Graham's house and pitched him on buying the magazine, and Phil bought. And 2 weeks later. Essentially, I think it was a little more than 2 weeks, the deal was done.
And Newsweek wasn't as important then as it became. Unfortunately, now it's not important again. But did that sale enhance Ben Bradley's career?
Absolutely. In the first instance, it made him the bureau chief of Newsweek. In the second instance, he received stock options, which ultimately brought him a great deal of his private wealth. And generally, I mean, Kennedy was his friend who was sitting in the Oval Office, and Ben was now the bureau chief of Newsweek. And Ben has always said at the Post, his goal was to get the Post to be said in the same breath as the Times. And when he was at Newsweek, it was to get it in the same breath as Time Magazine. And I think he would argue that he closed some of that gap with his work at Newsweek.
He also said that he and the Kennedys used each other.
I think that's a fair statement. I think even from Ben's own book, Conversations with Kennedy in 1975, I think it's pretty clear that there were some specific moments where Kennedy explicitly used him. I mean, gave him a story, said you can report this, but I get approval of it. And I think Ben, in hindsight, wasn't overly thrilled about that.
I have seen this play called The Columnist about Joseph Alsop,
mm-hmm.
who also felt that he used the Kennedys and the Kennedys used him.
Mm-hmm.
So the Kennedys were really
very savvy. They knew what they were doing. And Kennedy himself was a huge news junkie. He was a speed reader, and he would fly through the newspapers. And he knew what was being said about him at all times.
You write about Ben Bradley's luck meets fate way of life. Did he see it that way, too? Does he consider himself somebody who just happened to be lucky in some instances?
No. I mean, I think he has written that about himself, just that a lot of the great things in his life seem to almost have happened by accident. I think that's true of most people. I mean, it's certainly true of my own life. Even the writing of this book, it's like it just kind of unfolded in this organic way. It wasn't like I dreamed it up sometime. I don't think Ben would say that it's all luck. I think one of the things Ben says in the book, and I think it's one of the things that's very true of Ben, is that he operated at 100%. As he put it in one interview, he had no unused capacity. He threw all of himself into what he did, and I think if you're looking for a reason for success, I think that's one of the main reasons.
Well, you can get the job, but that doesn't mean that you then do well in the job.
Exactly, and it was not his. I mean, maybe a family connection got him an interview at the Post, but he made his own way once he got there.
My guest is Jeff Himmelman, who has worked on two national bestsellers, Bob Woodward's Maestro and Tim Russert's Big Russ and Me. He was also co-author of A Different Life with Quinn Bradley, and he's written for The Washington Post, The New York Times Magazine, and other publications. His new book is called Yours in Truth, A Personal Portrait of Ben Bradley. It is published by Random House, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Jeff Himmelman. His latest book, Yours in Truth, A Personal Portrait of Ben Bradley, which is published by Random House. During the time that the Kennedys were in the White House, Ben Bradley was married to his second wife, Antoinette, and you suggest in the book that At the very least, you believe there was a flirtation between JFK and Antoinette. Do we know if anything really happened between them?
Yes. Sally Bedell Smith reported in, I think, 2007, I hope I have that date right, in her book that Tony had told her about this incident, which I didn't know had ever been made public, but evidently it had been, in which and she had told her children about it, and they told me.
Spoke to her daughter.
I spoke to Rosamond Casey. Mm-hmm. And there was an incident on a boat where Kennedy kind of chased her around and made an advance at her. But she didn't, interestingly, tell Ben about that at the time.
When did he find out?
He found out later. When I asked him about it, he didn't remember. And she said to Sally Bedell Smith that she did it much, much later, not knowing exactly what the date was, but much later.
Mm-hmm. But that might have affected their relationship. Do you think the Post was too friendly to Kennedy?
Well, Ben was at Newsweek at that time. I think people have made that allegation. Ben always says that if you look at some of the stories, particularly some of the stories he wrote, are they pro-Kennedy? I think you could say they are. I think Kennedy won the election. People liked Kennedy. So I think the fact that it's favorable to Kennedy doesn't indicate any real bias in the reporting. But I think Ben had to navigate that personal and professional line, and I'm not sure he was ever entirely sure where it was.
And that is a problem more in Washington, I would think, than anywhere else,
sure,
where journalists wind up going to parties, having dinner right with the people they report on.
Right.
So how do you get past that?
Well, as he said it in an interview later, he said, you know, we were so close that we started to protect our friends, and he said, you can't let friendship interfere with history. And I always thought that was a very evocative thing to say.
Where was Bradley when Katharine Graham took over ownership of the Washington Post?
He was at Newsweek. And so the sort of legendary story of his hiring is that there was some dissatisfaction at the paper, and she took over, and people were wondering what the direction was going to be. And she had heard that Ben had been offered a promotion to the headquarters of Newsweek in New York twice, and that he had turned them down. And so she was curious about him. She knew he ran a good bureau. She was curious about him, and she invited him to lunch. And this is a famous lunch where they're talking about the managing editorship, and he says, I'd give my left one for the managing editorship. And I don't think he had to surrender it, but he ended up in that position.
But they don't seem to be an ideal pair, at least at first. She was a lot more politically conservative than he was.
Yes, and I think also I'm not sure she was certain when she took over at the paper that she was going to become this sort of crusading publisher of a newspaper. I think
she was kind of forced by the Pentagon Papers, and then
exactly. And I think she grew into this icon of American journalism. I mean, everybody says Ben is so courageous, and I think it's important to note Ben is courageous, but he couldn't have been courageous without Katharine Graham.
Well, she's written about getting calls from the White House, from the Nixon White House, telling
right
her to stop doing it, and getting pressure from an awful lot of friends. And
right.
She decided to go with...
Right, and she had these parties at her house where everybody would come. Kissinger would always come. I mean, she had these legendary parties at her house, so she was very much in that social swirl.
Well, their relationship got tighter, and there were rumors about the nature of their relationship.
Right, of course. Inevitable.
And the feeling she may have had for Bradley.
Right, and I explore some of that in the book, and I think it's very easy from the outside to speculate.
Well, you must have asked him.
Oh, of course. But what he wrote, I can't say here on the old public radio station. But essentially, you know, rumors about that. I mean, she would always say it's always so exaggerated. And he said, I never felt I had to defend myself in that. And I think that's a fair statement.
Since he's already written a memoir, did you feel that you had to revisit every possible part of his life?
I struggle with that. And it's a hard thing when there's this other thing out there that is so complete and almost encyclopedic. And so I decided to really focus on what brought him to journalism, because that really is what has defined his public life.
And he took over the executive editor post at the Washington Post in 1968,
mm-hmm.
An exciting time, the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Nixon just elected president. Did he do much to change the way the paper covered stories?
Absolutely, and that was his objective from the start.
You suggested he saw himself as in competition with the New York Times.
From the start, even if he wasn't necessarily, I'm not sure they saw him as the competition at first, but he certainly saw them as the competition. And the thing that he wanted, and there's a wonderful note in the book about when he first got there, he felt that you could see, and Carl Bernstein confirmed this with me, that you could really see that the Post had agendas in its coverage, particularly of events in the city, et cetera. And the first thing Ben wanted to do when he came in 65 as managing editor, but certainly by the time he was the executive editor, was to take that tilt out of the news. So he wanted writing with flair, he wanted writing with style, but he didn't want tilt.
Where was the tilt?
I think the tilt was there were some very cozy relationships between sort of government figures and people at the Post. And so there's a story that I talk about in the book in which one of the editors at the Post got wind that that Walter Washington was going to be appointed the mayor. And they wanted to have this sort of cozy meet the editors kind of thing. And Ben got wind of it and thought it was way too cozy and ended up printing it. He ended up confirming it, having a reporter confirm it, and then printing it in the paper the next morning, which enraged this other editor, Ben Gilbert. And Ben Gilbert wasn't around for much longer. But he really wanted to blow up some of those cozy relationships.
We've seen similar things happening more recently, in fact, at the Post, didn't we? There were proposed meetings, parties.
The Salon gate. I don't cover that in the book at all.
Obviously.
Yeah. I mean, the more recent history of the Washington Post is best written by somebody else.
Did Bradley bring Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein to the paper?
Mm-hmm. He sure did.
How involved was he in the initial Watergate coverage? Because the sense is, at least from the legend,
right,
that there was a lot of resistance and that Woodward and Bernstein insisted and eventually won out.
I mean, I think, you know, it's funny because when you watch the movie All the President's Men, so much of it is really true. But one of the things that isn't accurate in the film, and I talk about this in the book, is that for the initial stages of the story, Ben really was not in the driver's seat editorially. Howard Simons, who was the managing editor, Harry Rosenfeld, who was the Metro editor, Barry Sussman, who was the City editor, these guys were the guys who were really shaping the early Watergate stories, not Ben. Ben came in when it got heavy, and that was
right,
his job.
Had Bradley had more direct control of the Watergate story from the outset, he might not have picked Woodward and Bernstein to report on it. Why?
That's correct. I mean, Carl was known as kind of erratic in his work habits. That's how he put it with me. I think that's a good description. And Bob was very new at the newspaper. He had come in 1971, but he had been, I mean, front page story after front page story. He'd been doing a great job. But so they were two sort of lowly Metro reporters on the biggest story of the latter half of the 20th century. I mean, if you go back and think about it, you know, does it make sense that they were on it? Of course not, but it happened organically, and they did a heroic job.
And maybe a more veteran reporter wouldn't have done as good
a job. Precisely. They would have called their contacts and gone to their cocktail parties and maybe not ever have gotten as deep.
Jeff Himmelman's book, Yours in Truth, A Personal Portrait of Ben Bradley, is published by Random House. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I suspect that part of the encouragement of doing the Watergate coverage was that it made the Times look bad. After all, the Pentagon Papers had come from the Times.
Right.
And now the Times is kind of ignoring this story.
The Times got beat.
I'm talking about the New York Times.
Yes. The Times got beat pretty bad on Watergate, from what I understand. Although there were two very important stories in July of 1972 that advanced the sort of money trail that Carl then found this check on. In this story they put in the paper on August 1st, where Carl really found the money. And so the Times contributed to that storyline, but then essentially those reporters and Time magazine really kind of owned the story until the election.
And there have been some questions about whether the reporting tactics on Watergate were completely ethical. You discovered that Carl Bernstein had spoken to and received information from a grand juror, which is illegal, isn't it?
The lawyers have had lots of talks about this, and I think in some ways it's a gray area. Obviously, the grand juror herself took an oath, and so it's a contemptuous offense for a grand juror to leak information from a sealed proceeding. As far as I understand, I could be incorrect, but there is no—they did not get any legal judgment saying they could not approach the grand jurors, and so I'm not sure if it was illegal for them to contact her or not, but they did. That was one of the most interesting moments, obviously, in the archival research.
Well, I'd assume that as the story got bigger and bigger, he got more and more involved. Bradley.
Yes. Once he realized,
was he doing total nitty-gritty everything?
He got into the details. He said there was this famous story which came out. It was the one real mistake they made over the course of their reporting. And it was this October 25th story saying that Haldeman had been in control of the secret fund because of grand jury testimony. And it turned out that testimony hadn't actually occurred in front of the grand jury. And the night before that story ran, as I recount in the book, Ben had everybody in his office. And as they all describe it, he would grill them all like a prosecutor. What did this person say? What exactly did they say? So at that time, when the whole paper was riding on it, you better believe Ben Bradley was standing right there asking those questions.
Well, of course, he could also lose his job. The paper could have been sued.
That was at stake.
And lost everything.
That was at stake.
After Watergate, Sally Quinn, his third wife, likened his state of mind to postnatal depression.
Right.
Why? After all, he was a celebrity, soon to be portrayed by Jason Robards in a major film.
Right, but he didn't know that.
He was being depicted as a hero, wasn't
sure,
he?
Sure, but I think if you go back to 1974, I think at that time, even after Nixon resigned, I think everybody at the Washington Post was aware that the biggest story they would ever see had come and gone. And Ben is a guy who hunted for the big story. And I think to know that you'd had it, and then to know that you were going to now have to figure out what the rest of your career was going to be, I think that posed a challenge for him and for pretty much everybody at the paper.
When he was here, I remember asking him about why the Post hadn't gone after the S&L scandal a lot in more depth. And he said, people don't want to read about that. Their eyes glaze over when you have a lot of numbers.
Right.
Well, wasn't it his responsibility to cover those kinds of stories too? It was an important story.
Sure, you can argue that, and I think Ben would agree with that. I think Ben was kind of famous for not really liking those long sort of process stories, and Len Downey, who was his successor, was much more proficient at that, and the paper was a lot better at that under Len Downey than it was under Ben. But Ben wanted the big, flashy story that would get everybody talking.
So after Watergate, he took some time off and wrote that JFK book.
He did. He did. He went out to his house in the woods and he cranked it out.
I guess he wanted to do it while it was still fresh in his memory.
Well, it's an interesting moment in his life, and I have asked him about it, and what he has said to me and said to other people over the course of time is that he just wanted to do something different after all that involvement with Nixon. I'm not sure I buy that explanation completely, and I say that in the book. I think it was a moment where Ben didn't know what was next, and Watergate was really Woodward and Bernstein in terms of the public eye. The movie had not come out yet. And I think it was a moment where Ben thought, okay, what's my next move? I think there was a little more calculation involved than he lets on.
But he now is running a newspaper that is considered the equal to the New York Times for the first time in its history.
Right.
People spoke of the two newspapers in the same sentence always.
Right. So, right, and that was a source of great pride for him, absolutely.
But didn't he just feel responsibility to keep it up?
He did. And there was but the Post and the Times are very different papers, always have been, and their missions are different. And so the Post is really more of a local paper, always has been, than the New York Times. And in the late 70s, mid-70s, they could have made the decision to try to really be a national player. And the decision was made consciously or unconsciously not to pursue that path.
Then he comes back, and then the paper sees sees its reputation tarnished by the Janet Cook scandal.
Right.
An African-American reporter wrote a fabricated story about an 8-year-old heroin addict, and he stood by her and even submitted her piece for a Pulitzer Prize. It won the Pulitzer Prize. And then it blew up in their faces.
It sure did, in a colossal way.
How did it affect him personally?
I think Ben is not one to ruminate or linger over things, but if you go back and look at the record, and so, you know, when he said to me, you know me, I don't stick on these things for too long. But when you go back and look at the actual record, which I was able to do, it hurt him. And he wasn't sure he'd have a future at the paper. He wasn't sure Don Graham wasn't going to fire him. He offered to resign. But I think the most interesting thing about the Janet Cook thing, there are two things. Yes, he didn't necessarily know her all that well personally, but he certainly did stand by her, and he certainly did, in an institutional sense, trust her and back her. And in a lot of ways, there are echoes of Watergate in that. But the other echo of Watergate is that when the wrongdoing, when the falsehoods were exposed, Ben and the paper did a really remarkable internal investigation and printed the results in the paper, and that really ultimately cleared the way for them to recuperate.
But it also revealed that there were problems in the paper. Here you are in Washington, a majority African-American city.
Definitely.
And the newspaper does not reflect that. And when it finally does a story which had a certain basis in truth nonetheless,
right,
even though it was fabricated, it blows up in its face.
Right. And some of the racial dynamics are one of the real untold stories that I really do have in my book. And particularly, I mean, right as Watergate was happening, there were a group of African-American reporters who sued the Post for employment discrimination. And so that was always an issue. And it really – I track that as it led to Janet Cook. And in the D.C. community, there have been a lot of missteps around those issues, even continuing.
You have a remarkable letter that you can read for us.
I do. I think it shows who Ben is. There was a student at Yale who wrote him to say, you said that readers are the ones who hold you accountable, and I hope you'll remember this lesson and think a bit longer before answering the next time someone asks you, who keeps the press honest? And his response was to this student at Yale, who had a very WASPy-sounding name. He wrote, my God, you have gotten pompous at an early age. Your paraphrased question asks, how often do we see the media admit to inaccurate reporting? In the Janet Cook case, you saw the Post admit to inaccurate reporting. You saw the Post do it before anyone else. You saw the Post do it on the front page. You saw the Post apologize in an editorial. You saw the Post, unasked, return the Pulitzer Prize. So he goes on, and then he says, I'm speechless at your injunction that I should remember this lesson and think a bit longer. Before you settle down as a stockbroker or whatever and join the racket club or whatever, try to think for yourself if I may give you a piece of advice.
Well, he probably saw the people he grew up with in that letter as well.
Sure.
So I'm assuming he's read the book.
Yes. He has the book. He has the book. I gave it over to him on last Saturday. I brought it over.
How much longer after the Cook scandal did he stay on as executive editor?
10 years. Mm-hmm. He didn't retire until 1991. So he was there until he was 70, basically.
And then he decided to write his memoirs.
Exactly. Exactly. And that was what he did, I think, for those few years.
And now just relaxing?
He still goes to the paper every day. As he says, I'm a stop on the tour. People love to go up to his office and say hello. I mean, I encounter this phenomenon myself. You go see Ben Bradley, you feel better.
What about you? Having lived through the fallout from some of your book's revelations, would you have done anything differently?
In terms of my reporting, not at all. No.
And where do you go from here? Is anybody going to...
we'll have to see.
I'm not going to let you go through all of my letters. I have to tell you, Jeff.
Yeah, I may not get that kind of access again. We'll have to see. But I think it's to Ben's credit and Sally's great credit that they gave me the access that they did and stood by it.
And thank you so much for coming by to talk about the book. It's Yours in Truth, A Personal Portrait of Ben Bradley, written by Jeff Himmelman and published by Random House.